Anyhow, we are past the 7:30 start time, so welcome all to Q&A. If we have any guests with us, by all means, we welcome guests at any time. We are recording audio. The audio, along with the deck and the contents of the chat window, will go up on our website. I'm going to mute all, but everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so. If you have any questions or comments, please remute yourself afterwards to keep background noise to a minimum. And with that, Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We'll get going because we have quite a lot of material tonight. First off, a question came in about, is it time to upgrade to Windows 11? And although this lady doesn't need the features that it's offering, but wonders whether it's a good idea to do it anyway. I posted this in the members forum and we got a few responses. So if you have any thoughts on this, if you've actually tried Windows 11 and you want to chime in, put something in the chat or we'll come back to this question later. Open your mic and tell us your experiences. Okay, so first thing, we're going to go to smartphone basics and some small things and some big things. And this is last of the Mohicans from Micheline's list of complaints and questions about smartphones. First question, or first comment, the screen is too small. And the second thing, the icons at the top, the system icons, they're too small to decipher and they're too small to click on with a finger. So in terms of a tiny screen, I mean, that's a problem because phones are designed to be small, and the smaller the better generally. And if you have a tablet, you can get much bigger screens on tablets, 7-inch, 10-inch, and even bigger ones, and you get larger icons, but they're not quite as portable, so you kind of need a big pocket to carry it around. And however, if you do have a tablet, you can make phone calls and you can make video calls using voice over the internet, like apps like Bongo and WhatsApp are supported. And in fact, some tablets will even support telephone calls, either using a SIM card or Wi-Fi base. And Samsung Galaxy in particular have a call and text on other devices options. So it's kind of built into at least some of their systems. The tiny icons, it is a problem. They're kind of really small. The good news is you don't need to click on them because they're only there to tell you things, either notify you that something's happening or give you the status of some aspect of your telephone, like the battery charge level, for example. And the good news is there is a setting to increase their size. In the Android code, this parameter, status bar system icon size, you can reset that to change the size of the icons. Problem is, as far as I know, nobody has implemented that in an actual version of Android. So this is something you'd have to be an Android programmer. You'd have to get the code from the Android open source project, AOSMP, and do your own coding, create a custom ROM, and then you could change the size of the icons to your heart's content. They are tiny, but there is a bunch of guides online if you can't understand what they're trying to tell you. There's all kinds of websites that will list the icons, show you the actual image, and then give you a description of what the icon actually does. And you can also actually remove the icons from the status bar if they really bug you and don't give you any useful information. I guess you can make them go away completely. So those are all the tiny things. Now there's a really big issue, and the Micheline notes that the logic of the operating system hierarchy defeats me. And she thinks that you have to search for everything just like you do in Windows 10. And I love this quote here. It took me 40 years to figure out Windows. I don't have, like everybody else, on the call probably. I don't have another 40 years to figure out how to use Android. Well, again, the good news is that you don't have to search for everything. And Android is actually very customizable, and the display in particular. You can delete icons, you can add icons, you can arrange the icons however you wish. You can create shortcuts to specific files, and you can have a file manager that will let you create custom folders and organize files by category for documents and images and recent downloads, for example. And so there's a lot of different ways you can make your life easier. And you look on this is my home screen here, and you can see I've got a file manager up here. I've got WhatsApp there. I've got a link to my vaccination certificate. I've got the good old OPCUG site finder app. So one click gets me right into the website. And the camera's there, the shutdown app. So you can make your life easier by using all these kind of tools and techniques. The other thing is you're not limited to just one page. You notice down here there's a couple of dots, and that indicates that I'm on the home page, but there's another page if I swipe to the left, and I'll get a second page of custom icons that I don't use quite so frequently. So in terms of searching for everything, in fact, there is no search command. Now, unlike Windows, where you have a search command typically on the taskbar, or you use Cortana to ask how to do it, there is actually no built-in search command in Android that I'm aware of. But you can search in things like settings, and you can search for files in the file manager, and so on and so forth. So lots of things you can do. And in terms of the operating system, I just remind you that I created a series of articles on the file system. And as I said in the final one, it's intended to provide some details of an extremely complex file system. And it really is complex and confusing. So you have to spend a little time and figure your way through it, if that's what you need to do. Anyway, there's the articles for what they're worth, and learn all about Android's file system.
Natalie mentioned in the chat the group icons together as well, which is kind of a neat feature. I use that too. So all of the Google apps, you know, I have a basically like a folder, which has all of the icons all in that one group, and I just tap it. It opens up and allows me access to everything beneath it. So if you have limited real estate for the icons you want, you can try grouping some of them together.
I do exactly the opposite. I only ever use like one or two icons, so I pull them out of that complicated icon and then get rid of it. Okay, let's move along. We have a share here from Chris on Canadian Shield Browser.
Yeah, so CIRA is the Canadian Internet Registration Authority, so their primary task, I guess, really is they take care of the CA domain. And so anybody who wants a .ca, they have to go through CIRA to get it. But they do a lot of advocacy work, and they fund projects and things like that. They do a lot of very interesting work. It's a nonprofit organization, and I think that they're pretty trustworthy. So they have this thing they just came out with, the Canadian Shield Browser Extension, and they quote on there as an even easier way to surf safely. So that's a quote from them. And they can block hundreds of thousands of malware and phishing sites before you get to them. It is free. It's available for Google Chrome or any other browsers based on Chromium. It should work, as well as Firefox. They have an extension for that. Two quotes from their website, privacy is paramount. And CIRA does not store or sell your website browsing data. So next. So the way it works is that for any domains that are engaged in what they consider to be malicious phishing or scams, they will block access to that domain in the browser. And you will get presented with a block page. I don't know what it looks like because I don't know any malicious website that I could try on, and they don't have a testing web page, which would have been nice if they had a test web page just to be able to see what it looks like, but they don't, to my knowledge. And to install it, you just browse to the URL there, and I've pasted that into the chat window, and go using the browser you want to install the extension to. So if you want to go to it and install the extension in all your browsers, you'll just go multiple times in the browser that you want to install the extension to. And on that page, you'll see that box that says install now and hit next. So if you want it for Chrome or any of the Chromium-based browsers like Edge, Vivaldi, Brave, Opera, etc., click on the one that says Chrome. And it'll take you to the Chrome Web Store and click the button that says Add to Chrome. And it's if you're in Chrome, it will add it to Chrome. But if you go there using, for example, Edge, and you click Add to Chrome, it'll actually add it to Edge. Okay, so as long as you're in a Chromium-based browser, that's the way you get it installed. Or next, if you have Firefox, you click on the Firefox button, it'll take you to the extension store for Firefox and allow you to install it there. Next. So once you get it installed, you won't see it in the list of icons to the right of your URL bar as you normally see with various extensions like I've got. But you can configure it. So if you click on the extensions icon in there and next, it'll bring up this list of all the extensions you have installed. Next. And you go to the one that says Sierra Canadian Shield, and you click the dot, 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 which if you hover over top of that, it says more actions, and then you'll choose manage extension. Next. So this is the total sum of what you can do in it. So you can toggle it on or off. They give you some information about the extension, the version number, and things like that. And then there are four configuration options that you have. So you can go in, you can play around with those. Note that the defaults are, as you see there, it will work against all sites that you try to surf to. And then all of the other options are turned off by default, but you can turn them on if you want. And then if you want to remove the extension, that's the bottom option on there. So next. So the Sierra says that the Sierra Canadian Shield browser extension is powered by the Sierra Canadian Shield. So what is the Sierra Canadian Shield? So it's DNS-based protection. So the way DNS works or the way your computer works, it has no clue how to get to, for example, opcug.ca. It knows how to get to an IP address. So how does it know to get to the IP address? Well, that's DNS, the domain name system. So that's where you type in opcug.ca. Your computer uses DNS to go look up what is the IP address for that and then send you to that IP address all in the background, unbeknownst to you. So what the Canadian Shield and any DNS-based protection will do is rather than just blindly giving you the IP address, they'll look it up and say, well, is this a known malicious site that you're going to, opcug.ca or myhacker.com or whatever? And then if they think it's a malicious site, they will, rather than just passing back the IP address, they'll send you to a block page or some kind of indication that, yeah, this is a site you don't want to go to. We last looked at the Sierra Canadian Shield January 6, 2021, and I gave the URL to the PDF file on that particular Q&A session, and that's in the chat window as well. Next. So you can easily use Sierra Canadian Shield. So I can configure that on my computer in about 2 minutes. I can get it configured and then it's providing that protection. And then you can use both Sierra Canadian Shield and Sierra Canadian Shield browser protection. And because we know that computer security is all about layers. So you have additional layers so that if one layer fails in protecting you from whatever malicious action is going on, hopefully another layer will actually work to protect you. Next. So, wait a sec, though. If we have Sierra Canadian Shield, which is the DNS-based protection, and then we have Sierra Canadian Shield browser extension, which uses Sierra Canadian Shield, they're both providing the identical protection. So there's no real advantage to using the identical protection twice. If one fails, the other is going to fail. If one blocks it, the other one will block it. So there's really no advantage to having both of those in place. But you can take advantage of the fact that there are other DNS-based protections that are available. I use Quad9. It's a consortium of, I think, about 20 different security firms led by IBM. And they have terabytes and terabytes of threat intelligence that they use to do DNS-based protection. Neustar is another one that does a similar sort of thing. So why not use that alternative DNS service for the low-level protection, which should give you protection for everything, and then use the CIRA, Canadian Shield browser protection for browsers, to get CIRA's DNS-based protection working just within the browser itself. So because you're using two alternative services, you might end up with enhanced protection, where one, if one happens to miss it, maybe the other one will pick it up. So that would be my advice, is to use something a little bit different for the two different layers. And don't forget about the other layers of protection on your computer. You know, going from the bottom up, you have antivirus, you have patch management, making sure that you have all your software up to date for security vulnerabilities. You have a firewall in place, account management, so you don't have, you know, your passwords leak out and other people able to hijack your accounts. And then above all, be suspicious. And I'll have more to say about be suspicious later on in tonight's session as well. But that's it for that.
There's a question in the chat, Chris. What does the allow in incognito option do?
If you go in incognito method, when you're in incognito mode, if you have on something like this, incognito mode is no longer able to provide all of the incognito methods that will keep your data from leaking out. So if you have this turned on, in theory, CIRA, the ones who are actually getting this, giving you this protection, they will actually get data about the page that you're trying to visit. And so they turn that off by default because they are really serious about the fact that they don't want to be in any way, shape, or form looked upon as being invasive on your privacy. And so if you're in incognito mode, they're figuring, well, maybe you really do want to be incognito, and so they don't want to insert themselves into that data stream anywhere. But you can turn it on if you want to allow them to have access to the sites that you're actually visiting.
So Lawrence likes the look of your cake. I think he wants to buy a slice, and your messaging is Lawrence approved. And Tom notes that you can set browser to access DNS from Quad9 using TLS encryption.
Yeah, I've often questioned about that. Maybe we can have a discussion in the future on that. You know, what is the real value of doing DNS with TLS encryption? I'm not, so far, entirely convinced that it's really buys you an awful lot, but it might be a good discussion to have in the future.
Yeah, Tom says it avoids money in the middle in cafes.
Yeah, but if you're really concerned about it in a cafe, you probably want to use a VPN anyways. But
so Natalie is asking, if your browser is set to incognito mode, does Canadian Shield take over?
No. If you are in incognito mode by default, Canadian Shield will not work. It just doesn't do anything. It would only be if you go in and you actually turn on that particular option that the Canadian Shield browser protection would actually function. And I think they're trustworthy enough that personally I would enable that option because if you go in incognito mode and then you go to a malicious site, the Canadian Shield browser protection would not be protecting you unless you turn that on. And I do trust CIRA.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And you've got another share here on the state of cybersecurity.
Yeah, this is I love these reports that come out of security companies out there. They most of them will come out with these yearly reports on cybersecurity. Reason Labs has a long history, started by a gentleman who he actually wrote Giant anti-spyware, which Microsoft bought the company and turned into Microsoft Security Essentials, which turned into Windows Defender, which turned into Microsoft Defender. So it's got a long history. So this Reason Labs was actually started by this same gentleman. So this report, the data is taken from the whole year of 2021, and it includes data from over 180 countries. Some of the key takeaways I thought were interesting. 2021, they assessed as the year of the miner. So that's where your computer will basically be taken over to mine cryptocurrency, where you don't get the money of anything that any coins that are mined, the attacker does. They said phishing through documents and email was still very popular. We didn't make the top 10 even in terms of countries and average detections per user. The top 5 rated 1 to 5, Russia being number 1, are on the screen there. They noticed a decrease in the number of threats that were trying to play on COVID-19 and trying to get you to do things that you probably shouldn't do. Info stealers, they said, are extremely popular. That's ones where they will try to hack your computer to get credentials to things, a lot of stealing of cryptocurrency wallets, things like that. And the last one I found really curious. In 2022, they are actually expecting a shift in the hacker focus back from enterprises to consumers. And I find that really curious because enterprises have a lot of money. So if they successfully attack a large enterprise, they could get millions of dollars. You know, the consumers, you know, nobody's going to be paying $1 million to get their computer back. They might pay $100, couple hundred dollars, but to me, that seems like an awful lot of work. However, even if you're not interested in trends, if you are not up to date on the types of malware that are out there and the threats that are out there and just really good descriptions about what these are about, they're really well defined within that report. So that report is there, and I will paste that into the chat window.
Thanks, Chris. I wonder whether that shift is because enterprises are getting smart, and now they have really solid backup systems, so that they don't pay ransom. Whereas yeah. Joe User, you know, he won't have a backup, and he want to get his data back, maybe.
I think you give enterprises entirely too much credit.
Just a thought.
Yeah.
Okay. Another question came in this week on internet outage. What was the explanation for the Rogers outage? And could the same thing happen to Bell? And then, so Chris has got a couple of comments on that. And then the next question I thought was interesting. Have other countries experienced similar outage problems? So I've got a few things I'll say about that. So, Chris.
Yeah, this is probably nothing new to anybody now, but in the early days, or the first word that came out of Rogers that was an admission to what was going on, they actually say that it was caused by a network system failure after they did a maintenance update. So, in other words, they pushed out an update to their internal network, the core network, that obviously wasn't tested well enough, and it caused the system to fail. I'm surprised that it took them a day to back out from that failure, but that's it. Michael Geist has an interesting take on it. That's one of his first postings, and I posted the URL in the chat. That's one of his first takes on it. He had an interesting thing. Michael Geist, for anybody who doesn't know, he's a professor of law at the University of Ottawa. He's also the Canada Research Chair in Internet and e-commerce law. And he loves taking the big telecoms to task over things. And so one of the interesting things that he mentioned in this was the idea that there's opposing viewpoints or benefits and risks involved when you concentrate the things into the hands of few. He says, yeah, concentrating all of the infrastructure into few could be a bad thing, but in the next paragraph, he talks about the benefits you get by bundling your services with a single provider. And so I kind of chuckled at that one a little bit, but yeah, if anybody who had, you know, internet, TV, phone with Rogers They were completely out, whereas people had split up their services. They still have some services available, but Michael Geiss is saying how you pay a premium to get that spread out like that way, whereas if you go with one, you know, you do get that bundling cost involved. So it was kind of interesting take. And there's lots of other postings Michael Geiss has had since the one you see on the screen. If you're interested, go check out his blog, and there's a lot of other information he has.
I think part of his take, Chris, was that maybe telecoms shouldn't bundle things and you should be able to spread things out at reasonable kind of cost.
That could, yeah, that might actually be really what his point was. He didn't explicitly state it that way, though.
Yeah, and of course, that's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And talking about outages, some interesting outages. Here's an example. I think this was in BC. The internet service went down in a particular area, and the crew went out and found that one of the power lines had been taken down, and they could see the chew marks at the bottom, which told them who the culprit was. So it's a classic Canadian internet outage problem. In other countries, shutting down the internet can be deliberate on the part of governments who basically are trying to restrict people's access to various things. Fortunately, I don't think we have that problem in Canada, but clearly it's a concern in some other countries. And this is an interesting site, five of the biggest network outages. The first one was a typical cyber attack affecting United States and Europe. This was a denial of service attack. British Airways had an IT failure. Basically, a maintenance contractor turned off an uninterruptible power supply, and that damaged their server and took the whole network down. Amazon lost service because their server was experiencing high error rates, and it decided it was going to shut down because it couldn't cope. And then apparently in Armenia, you have a problem with 75-year-old ladies who go digging for scrap metal and cut through your LAN cable. I guess that's the equivalent of the Canadian beaver in Armenia. And I saved the best for the last. The best for the last here was a UK problem, Vodafone data center. And a bunch of thieves broke in using sledgehammers to steal things. So that kind of tells you whatever software systems you have in place to protect yourself ain't going to work if they come in with sledgehammers. So other people do have outage problems for sure. Okay, another question came in about the Microsoft service agreement, and Chris has some thoughts on that.
Yeah, so Corinne got an email saying, and it was in her spam folder, which I chuckled a little bit at. So it claimed to be information about an update to the Microsoft Security Agreement that was going to start on August 15th. And she was concerned about wanting to confirm that it was actually for real before she actually clicked on any of the links. Now, my first thought, and if Corinne is on the call, and she is, and go next. Did you ever read the full agreement? Because you did have to agree to the Microsoft Services Agreement at some point, either installing or configuring a new computer with Windows or whatever. It does pop up from time to time, at least at the install point of Windows. And so the full agreement is actually 34 pages long, 15,485 words is the current agreement. And so I guess my question is, if you didn't agree to or if you agreed to the first one, or you're not using Windows, so if you agreed to the first one, you don't really have an awful lot of choice about agreeing to the update, quite frankly. So in other words, does it really matter what the update actually says? Now, I'm being a little bit facetious in that, because I think that it is interesting to know what is being foisted on us when, even if we don't really have an opportunity or realistic alternative to accepting it, sometimes it's nice to know what it's all about. So next. But the next thing I thought, which could be a learning thing here at Q&A, is just the idea of, okay, Corinne didn't know how to validate whether that email was legitimate or not. So that's a good question, is how do you know an email is legit? So when I looked at the services, this email, which I got as well, and I think all people with Microsoft accounts actually got this email. And so if I look at the from, you know, it looked legitimate. If the domain name ended in Microsoft.com, so the fact that it has communications before that, you go from the .com, the first domain part of the domain name, to the left of the .dot whatever, is you know, the real owner of everything that is going to the left of that. So this from address is a Microsoft.com email address, but the from address can actually be faked fairly easily. So that alone is not an indication or proof that the email is legit. But if you saw anything fishy in there, you could definitely know that, okay, this doesn't look legitimate. So at least it doesn't look illegitimate at that point in time. Next. Then I hovered over the links that they want you to click on to read the entire service agreement or the FAQ page. And if you hover over it, then you look down at the status bar, and we have https://go.microsoft.com/fwlink/, and then a whole bunch of gobbledygook. Well, Microsoft uses these links on an awful lot of things. So go.microsoft.com and then forward link is what that stands for, and they'll use that to be able to link to things and keep URLs down to a reasonable length. And so they use it all the time, so that actually looks pretty good. There was no other flags. I didn't see any poor grammar. I didn't see anything to whom it may concern or things like that. It all looked official. It looked legitimate. So next. The last thing I did was, and I didn't actually do this until afterwards because I thought, this looks pretty good for me. But if you wanted to take a step further, I would have Googled, has Microsoft updated their services agreement? So I did that, and actually there are quite a few links, and some of them went to actually Microsoft sites and had more information about it. And you had third parties that were saying, oh, yes, Microsoft has updated it and so forth. And there was nothing at Google that pointed to the fact that, oh, no, there's a scam floating around right now saying that the update was came out and it's not real. So I think all of those put together are means that I would have used to determine that this email was in fact legitimate. And it was actually kind of neat because I actually spurred me on to actually read the FAQ on this services update. And next.
Tom is actually noting when you're checking the domain name, you got to make sure that there's no lookalike characters in the URL.
Yeah, that can be tricky for sure. There are Unicode characters that will look identical, and then there are things like, is it a zero or a capital O, and you know, some things like that. There are some ways of checking out those, and I've written articles in the newsletter on that, so you might want to check out the newsletter articles I've written on lookalike characters in URLs. So it actually spurred me on to actually read it. And these are the highlights as I see them. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so don't take this as gospel in terms of, Chris said this was right. You can read it for yourself. And if you're super concerned, you could have your lawyer read it. But I'm not sure it'd be worth having a lawyer read it. So the highlights as I saw it, first thing was they updated the date and the effective date and some things like that. They clarified Microsoft Start has guidelines applying to user content conduct, and so that's just things that you will not, you know, use this platform for illegal purposes, things like that. The Republic of Korea, they have certain rights that can't be limited by contracts, so it clarifies that. Now, I highlighted two lines in here, and I thought those were items that perhaps there are people on the call here who may actually have concerns with this. So Xbox services, they clarified that they are sharing data with industry partners and not just game developers, which was what they were saying before. So they are sharing data a little bit wider than you may have known in the past. Do you have any choice if you want to use Xbox services? No, but maybe it's interesting to know that. Terms and conditions were more prominent, easier to find. An interesting one, the Xbox services subscription new policy. They will actually turn off, or they can turn off, recurring billing if you don't use your subscription for a period of time. That's kind of neat, that rather than just billing you forever, if they notice that you're actually not using Xbox services, they'll turn off that recurring billing and stop charging. So that's kind of cool. They have clarification on what their obligations are to offer access to emergency services such as 911. So good thing to know what they figure their obligations are in that regard. They took out certain terms, Microsoft banned, it's no longer available. So they took out a bunch of stuff on that. They clarified that Microsoft Soundscape is general purpose consumer service. I don't know a clue what that means. In the notices section, they updated status on some licenses and patents. Yeah, very nondescript things in here. I don't think they'll really affect anybody. And then they improved clarity, grammar, typos, similar issues. So to me, it looks pretty innocuous. And from the email, you don't even have to go to the services agreement to see this. Right in the email, it says, if you do not agree, you can choose to discontinue using the products and services and close your Microsoft account before the terms become effective. So that's your remedy if you find that these terms and conditions are too onerous for you to accept. And I put in the URL into there, and that's gone out on the chat as well. So if anybody wants to actually read it, you can see all of the details about what the services agreement says. That's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Our next item is a thing that came in from Stuart, an app called Dead Man's Switch. And basically, this is a website that lets you, for a fee, some of it's free and some of it's paid for. Basically, you give them some emails and some email addresses of people. They send you an email occasionally, and if you don't respond, they figure that you must be dead, and then they send your emails to your stated contacts. And good old Stuart Bruce says it could be handy for some of us mature types. And so if that kind of thing interests you, then there's an interesting option. A bit like having a neighbor come and knock on the door, except this is an electronic version, remote electronic version. Okay, so I said we'd come back to this question, whether it's time to upgrade to Windows 11, even if you don't need the features. And I did put this on the forum, and I got a bunch of answers. And the one I really liked came from Andrew Weber. He says, no. And apparently he's going to give us more details when he gets home and has a real keyboard. So it'll be interesting to see what his take on. And clearly he's not a big fan of Windows 11 by the look of it. As it is Tom. Tom says one reason not to go to Windows 11 is that it doesn't support a taskbar on the left side of the screen. And so it looks like Tom ain't going to change very quickly. On the other hand, Andrew says his upgrade from 10 Pro to 11 Pro went very smoothly, and all of his lots of programs worked without any problems. The one thing he did come across with a batch file that he uses to run a command string to disable BitLocker on a particular drive that didn't work, and he has to find an equivalent command. And the thing he didn't like in Windows 11 was a new start menu. So he's installed a third-party product from Stardock called Start 11, and it gives him better control over the start menu. And now Lawrence has some other thoughts. So I think, Lawrence, you're going to share your screen at this point?
No, we'll go through the three slides.
Okay.
So anyways, look at I have to plan for Windows 11 because at some point Microsoft is going to say, to those of us on Windows Home and Windows Pro. Oh, if you're good, you're going to be on Windows 11. Thank you. Bye. And, you know, I would rather be planning for that ahead of time till when Microsoft decides to pull the switch. Now, I don't think that's going to happen for another year, but, you know, who knows what's in Microsoft's mind at any time. Yeah, and long story short, I made the point, Windows 10 will be supported, and, you know, we've reiterated that. Chris and Alan have reiterated that, this in the past. It's good to October 2025. And, you know, I make the argument that if you're happy with it, you're happy with your machine, great. Because chances are, by 2025, you're going to be investing in a new machine. And, yes, I'm assuming that, you know, you don't hold on to your machine more than 4 years at a time type of thing. I know a number of you have machines that are much older. Alan. You know, if Microsoft has flagged that your Windows 10 machine is ready for Windows 11, you have a Microsoft account, not any using any unique or unusual software, and you'll know, you know, this is one of those statements. Well, how do I know if I have unique or unusual software? If you're having to ask the question, chances are you don't fall into this camp. This is people with, you know, I can think of CAD programs, you know, some of the stuff that Bob has mentioned, if there's a program that he uses to rip his CDs and he doesn't want to give that up and they don't have any indication that they support Windows 11. You know, whatever the reason is, you know, don't put yourself through the strain. It's not worth it. Just make sure that your antivirus and other utilities are Windows 11 ready. Interesting trend had a update to say, oops, like 3 weeks ago. And they said, well, we're getting completely Windows 11 ready, but the last update has thrown us for a loop, blah, blah, blah. Do a full backup, of course. Chris has covered that off many times. And then go ahead with the update. You can, if you don't like it, you can go back to Windows 10 within a couple of days. I'm told that that is fairly seamless, but don't wait a month and then decide, oh, now I have a Windows 11 remorse. I want to go back to Windows 10. You may not be as happy with that process, but then again, you have your full backup, right? Next slide. So I wanted to state I'm using Windows 11. Actually, I have another work machine that's on Windows 11. I'm also using Windows 365 virtual machines. That's a story for another time. Another interesting Microsoft rollout. I'll just leave it at that. But irregardless, you know, I'm not wowed either way. I'm going to be doing a further presentation in the fall. So, you know, the reality is that if you want to stick with Windows, Windows 11 will be your thing. Whether you like it or not, doesn't really matter. I know. I feel like I'm the Borg. You will be assimilated. Anyways, I'm now going to share my screen, which I'm going to do right now once I find the share button, which you'd think I'd be able to find real quick. Yes. And, okay. So we're going to be looking at this every once in a while, but this is from October, so, you know, we got a couple of months into it. I suspect we're going to get an update on this real soon, but as you can see, you know, 19% for Windows 11, and then you have, you know, this is probably the big set of numbers here. I'm trying to remember, is it 20H2 that was just discontinued? I'm looking to Chris or Alan. I'm going to say I think so. You're muted, Chris.
I don't remember, but it's one of them.
Yeah, they're on a two-year servicing thing. So, yeah, it would be 20H2 would have been what was discontinued, I guess.
Yeah. So, anyway, so here's, you know, the doing the quick math here. We got 54. Well, actually, 55% on the current version, 20% on Windows 11, and then everything beyond that. Now, the other thing I wanted to say or take a quick look at is, hey, how does this compare to everybody? And I'm always interested in this figure because I have a lot of Mac enthusiasts that keep on hitting me over their head with their like of Mac, and I don't blame them. But irregardless, if you ever wonder why there's more software built for Windows than there is for anything else, 87.56%, that says it all. So there's a number of programs that are Windows-centric that won't run on anything else. I know, you know, Alan has shown us many programs that will run in Linux. That being said, if you're just a user, I can think of my parents as being a good example of that. They just want something that they can use and that they feel comfortable with. Well, anyways, Windows is still the main game in town. And at that, I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Lawrence. I don't think anything came in the chat.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so we have about 10 minutes left, and we were going to have Bob Walker. Bob, are you going to do part of your presentation?
Yeah, I've decided where I can split it in two and finish off the rest next time around.
Okay, so let me, why don't you share your screen and go for it.
Yep, here we go. And let me okay, everybody can see the proper screen here?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so tonight I'm going to be covering organizing your songs and music videos, part one. And I was going to do a part two next time, but I guess part one will be part of part two, and we'll do part two as part three. So far in this series, we've seen how to download videos or just the soundtracks of videos from YouTube, how to capture videos, how to capture or rip the audio from a video file, how to rip your CDs to MP3s, and how to edit the tags or the metadata for your MP3s. And, of course, you can also download lots and lots and lots more videos, songs, and even movies and a lot of other stuff from many places on the Internet, including iTunes, and your friends can give you lots of stuff, too. So now you have all these great songs and associated videos. How do you organize them and keep track of them? In this session, we'll start to look at organizing your songs and music videos. And one way to do this, to manage this collection, is to use media management software. Now, depending on the features of the particular media management app, they can automatically detect and catalog all the music and other media files on your computer. Sometimes they do this while leaving the files where they are. And sometimes they move all the associated files into their own database. They can allow you to search and sort by artist and or song title and or album and or genre and any other criteria. They can synchronize your libraries between your computers and your smartphone and any other devices you have. Some of these media management apps can do the ripping, tagging, and burning that we've used separate software for so far in this series. And all of the media management software apps include media player functionality. Now, here's a warning. As much as media management software can do a lot of wonderful things for you, the learning curves are quite steep. If you want to do anything much beyond the most basic functions, and you must be disciplined and diligent about using it, or you'll just add extra layers of disorganization and chaos to any already existing disorganization and chaos you already have. Now, there's a great review of some of the media management apps at the URL given there, and Chris will probably have that pasted into the chat. So let's have a quick look at some of these choices. MediaMonkey is arguably the best music library software for Windows 10. They also have an Android and an iOS version. They have a very comprehensive range of features and tools that covers virtually any media situation manageable. It's very customizable, including different skins. And the same warning that goes to the other tools, there's a very steep learning curve. I've tried MediaMonkey, but after having a good look at it and whatever, I decided I wasn't willing to put the time and effort in to learn it to get the most out of it. They have a free version, which is very capable and can probably do most of what you want it to do. And the full-featured paid version is only $25. The official website URL is there, as well as a URL for a very comprehensive review that goes much deeper than most software reviews do, and can give you a lot of the advantages and gotchas of MediaMonkey. Another top-rated app is MusicBee. It has a lot of the same features and abilities as some of the other apps. A noticeable feature is that MusicBee is freeware. But unlike a lot of other freewares, they actually offer reasonably good installation and administration help on its official website. It's freeware and it's supported by donations. And there's the official website there. Other apps you might want to consider, and the review I pointed out earlier has a lot more details on these. There's good old Windows Media Player from Microsoft. It has powerful sets of music organizing and media player features. A lot of people use it. It's been around for many years, but it's still buggy as hell. So if you're not already involved in this, you might want to steer clear of it. There's iTunes from Apple. Most of us are familiar with iTunes as a place to go and buy your music and videos and movies and a lot of other stuff. There's also the media management side of things. One thing about iTunes is whatever of your own stuff you load into your iTunes library, Apple knows all about it. So I may be doing a quick look at iTunes later on in this series, just some of the gotchas and whatever, because it has some idiosyncratic issues. Foobar 2000 is another good music library software app, and they have the Windows and the Android versions. It's quite widely used and has a total of 30 million users. And then there's iMusic. Now, iMusic is not from Apple. It's quite good, but it's relatively expensive. It's $40 per year per computer. You can get a lifetime license for $60 for the current version. And a lifetime for up to five computers for $150. And another thing to note, the term iMusic is used by other organizations for other things, So the term iMusic is definitely not limited to this app. Now, when you're using a software app for a specific purpose, for example, screen capture, video editing, CD ripping, a whole lot of other things, and you want to change, it's relatively easy to change or even just to try out a different app. However, if you're using a database app, changing over to a different app can be a lot more involved, and I won't really get into this. Now, since I made a living developing database apps, it's sort of strange for me to sort of badmouth them a bit, but for the average casual user, you might want to think twice. So if these apps are great, if you're willing to spend the time and effort required to learn and use them, but is there an easier way? Yes, there is, and that's good file management. Okay, it's free, it's easy, and if you get behind with your organizing your music and music video files and have them running wild all over your computer and other devices again, it's quite easy to get caught up and straighten things out. And so we're going to cover most of the good file management next session, but just a couple of differences here. With the database application, you can sort and search on any one of several criteria. For example, artist, song title, album, genre, either separately or several at once. Using basic file management, you have to choose what the most important criteria is to sort or search on, and then organize the files and directories accordingly. And for a music collection, the most important criteria is usually artist. So we'll look at using that as a key criteria to build the collection around. And so next time around, we'll also look at a few of the workarounds or cheats to get around these limitations. So you have an idea what to look forward to next time, and I'll finish up the rest of this deck. So let me stop sharing here. And Alan, I'll send you the revised shortened deck there for you to distribute right after this Q&A is over.
Okay, thanks very much, Bob. And I guess we'll look forward to two more parts in your new series, or your extended series, I guess. Okay, so we're right on 8:30, so I guess I didn't say there were no other questions in the chat.
Yeah, there was one actually that was kind of interesting. Sergio asked if Edge still was the default browser and made it virtually impossible to change away from it to another third-party browser. And I haven't been following it really closely, but I know Paul Thurrott has been following this quite closely. And at least in the insider builds in Windows 11, apparently they have made it easier to change to a different default browser, but there are some things that will still only open in Edge, such as a Cortana request. So anything going to Cortana will actually open up Edge as opposed to what your default browser is. But apparently it's a lot easier for you to say a different browser as your default and have it take over more of the protocols and so forth, so that it should open up whether you're opening up a URL from email or a link or whatever. So strides are being made, but it's far from perfect as it stands so far.
And Lawrence is noting that he uses Edge by default, but for general browsing, he's using Chrome. And one of the things is IBM's ordering site won't work with Edge. So I guess hopefully you can always switch browsers in Windows 11, or you might not be able to order anything from IBM ever again. Okay. So thanks everyone for chipping in tonight with lots of good content and lots of good questions. Our next Q&A will be next Wednesday, July the 20th, and we're looking for questions and we're looking for shares. So again, if you have material that you want to present to the group or questions that are burning a hole in your back pocket, then send them along to suggestion box and we'll see if we can find somebody to answer them. And that's it for me. So thanks everyone for attending and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.
Stop.